Hello, everyone. This is Rod again. This episode requires some explanation. This is a little out of the ordinary. I've not done an interview for the Bloody Pit before, and this one was really more of a target of opportunity than really anything else. I have, of course, done a few interviews over on the NashyCast, a brief one with Caroline Monroe, in which the circumstances were pretty similar to the one you're about to listen to, and a couple of private interviews with Tim Lucas, where we kind of picked over several Paul Naschy films and kind of looked at Paul Naschy as a genre filmmaker. In this case, every year I try to go to Wonderfest, a little convention in Louisville, Kentucky. I have a number of friends that I only get to see there, and it's always fun to get together and spend the weekend drinking, eating, and just shooting the bull with these folks. Well, over the past 3 or 4 years, one of these people has turned out to be William Stout, renowned artist and film production designer, and a man of many, many talents. And it's been fun to get to know him simply because the first conversation William Stout and I had was in a corridor in the Wonderfest Hotel, where I noticed he was carrying some CDs, noticed the cover of them was something that I thought I recognized, and stopped him and we started talking. And for the next hour plus, we stood in the hallway and talked music. And I knew who he was, but to be honest, this was the first lengthy conversation we had, and it was a lot of fun. Not just because it was fun to talk music, which I do love to do, but also because William Stout has a lot of really interesting stories. And his telling of stories about doing album art for bootleg albums years and years in the past were just as entertaining as discussing the minutiae of joy that we have for different artists and different albums and different things of that nature. So, getting to know William Stout in that way a few years ago led, naturally enough, into long late-night conversations around a table with him and Tim Lucas and a few other people that I'll name it other times when I interview them for just such a podcast as this. And one of the great things about that is just how many great stories he has. Now, several months ago, as part of their large collection of releases from the vaults of the Roger Corman collection, Shout Factory put out a quadruple film set of sword and sorcery films that were produced in the 80s during the barbarian boon that came along after the success of Conan the Barbarian. And I picked it up because, of course, I love these movies. It's a terrible weakness. I know it is. I have no excuse for it, but I have this incredible weakness for the barbarian movies of the 1980s. I could try to stretch a point and say, hey, it's because I also love the Hercules movies and Machiste movies and all the Muscle Man movies from the late 50s all the way through the 60s. Because I do. But honestly, I think I saw these movies first. And as cheesy and just downright bad as a lot of them are, I can't stop loving them. And so when this four film set hit the shelves, I picked it up. It has the first two Deathstalker films, and understand that there were four Deathstalker films, and I've only seen the first one so far. They're fun, or at least the first one's fun. And the other two films in the set were, one was a film I had not seen before, but the fourth is a movie called The Warrior and the Sorceress. And this movie I knew. I had seen this back when it had been originally released on VHS in the 80s, and I had enjoyed it then, even though, and here's the neat part, a very odd thing occurred while I was watching The Warrior and the Sorceress. Even back then, I noticed, hey, this is A Fistful of Dollars / Yojimbo. This is the same story, being transported from feudal Japan, say the Old West, say now being put into a barbarian-themed milieu. And I was fascinated. It was the first time that I'd ever run across like a number three kind of remake, because that's what it is. The movie is a remake of Yojimbo via Fistful of Dollars, via whatever you want to talk about. Now, this in the ensuing, what is it, 30 years now? God save me. Has become kind of a favorite topic of mine. I love delving into the various adaptations / ripoffs of Yojimbo, with the knowledge, by the way, that Yojimbo was a takeoff on Dashiell Hammett's novel, Red Harvest, in the first place. So it was a great joy years later to notice that director Walter Hill had turned the story in on itself, and with a movie called Last Man Standing, where he essentially set it back in the same kind of time period that Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest was originally set. So, Warrior and the Sorceress is an interesting little movie from a number of perspectives. I'm not going to say it's a good movie, but I will say it's one that I thoroughly enjoy. Let me talk about a few things about it first. It stars David Carradine, and this is a pretty good performance from Carradine in his typical post-Kung Fu time period. He did a good job, but there was always this thing with David Carradine in that period of the 80s and 90s where, honestly, there was always a sense, at least for me as a viewer, that he was kind of winking and nodding while he was doing what he was doing, that maybe most of the time he wasn't taking it that seriously, and maybe that's how he enjoyed himself while making these movies. I don't really know. But David Carradine, for me anyway, is always fun to watch. And let's just say there are other joys in this movie. First, it's fun to see this storyline play out in a sword and sorcery kind of setup. But another thing that's really interesting is that the movie is short and it moves very quickly. It follows the plot. It does a lot of things well. And just as a side thing, there's a copious amount of nudity in this thing. I mean, large amounts of nudity, especially from the main female co-star who plays the titular sorceress. She's very, very attractive, and that is not something to be sneered at. So, Warrior and the Sorceress. If you're into this type of film, I do recommend it, but here's where the surprise comes in. This time around, as I start to rewatch this movie for the first time since I was a wee teenager, I noticed that in the credits was a strange thing. William Stout's name. Now, at first I thought, this cannot be the William Stout I know, because during this time period I knew he was doing work on Conan the Barbarian and Conan the Destroyer and a bunch of other films around that area. And I thought, I don't know that he has any screenplay credits. Has he ever written scripts? This is interesting. This is, if so, well, it's just got to be somebody with the same name, right? So I did some hunting. And it turns out that it is the same William Stout. The same Stout who did the production design on Masters of the Universe and production design on half a dozen other films and worked on Dune, for God, you know. Come on, think about it. He co-wrote the script for this thing? Huh, interesting. So I fired off an email to Mr. Stout, and he replied. I asked him simply if he'd be willing to sit down at Wonderfest and do a brief interview about this particular film and just about any other topic that he'd be willing to talk about. And luckily, he said yes. So, that is how this came about. We sat down and recorded a brief snippet of conversation where I asked him about this particular movie and a few of the things that he was willing to talk about right off the top of his head that kind of connected in a way. And had a lot of fun. I always like talking to Mr. Stout. He is, he's got a lot of stories. He's a fun, fun person to just sit around and BS with. And, well, I think you'll hear just how much fun it is to talk to Mr. Stout. I'm going to apologize up front for the sound quality of this. We recorded this brief interview in a hallway there at Wonderfest on the last day of the convention. And so I'm not altogether happy with the sound quality all the time. But honestly, for the insight, the stories, and the jokes, well, I wouldn't call them jokes, just damn funny anecdotes, let's put it that way. I think it's well worth your time to hear this. And the good news is, Bill apparently enjoyed doing this. So I think we're going to do the same thing next year. And this time I think I'm going to see if I can get him off into a room where people aren't walking past us all the time and stopping to discuss their travel plans. So maybe this will become a regular feature. If I'm very, very lucky, next year I'll get him to talk in depth about Dune. Oh, man. There's a movie I'd like to know more about the production side of, just from the sheer joy of looking at that thing. But anyway, here's a brief interview with William Stout. And I'll come back afterwards and let you know a few more. I'll let you know some contact information for Mr. Stout if you want to see some of his artwork, which I highly recommend. And if you'd just like to learn more about him, he is well worth getting to know. And you won't meet a nicer, funnier guy. So, hope you enjoy this, and we'll talk to you afterwards.
Journey now to an age undreamed of. An age of mystery and magic. Of swords and sorcery. The warrior and the sorceress. On a planet lit by twin suns, evil warlords battle to control the fate of an entire dynasty. A mighty warrior rises out of legend to free an enslaved sorceress.
There was a time when I could command,
and I would obey.
Together, they forged the mystical sword whose blade cannot be broken. The ultimate struggle between good and evil. Sorcery. Dungeons. David Carradine in The Warrior and the Sorceress. The mightiest of all heroes. In the greatest of all adventures. The Warrior and the Sorceress. Their sacred bond cannot be broken.
When I rewatched Warrior and the Sorceress, yeah, and spotted your name in the credits, I was a little surprised, and I thought, well, maybe there's somebody else with that same name. Yeah. And when it turned out to actually be you, I was a little surprised, but not that shocked when I realized, you know, looking down the list of credits at the same period of time. But what was surprising is that your credit was for a script, was for story and screenplay.
Right.
I only know of three credits for you in that category. Is that about right? This, you said this was your first one?
That was the first screenplay I ever sold. I wrote another screenplay and sold it to Jim Henson.
Oh, really?
And I wrote an episode of the animated Godzilla series.
Okay, yeah, that's listed on the IMDb.
Okay, but I also wrote a number of spec scripts. I wrote Conan the Buccaneer.
Oh, really? Is that based on the...
It's based on the Robert E. Howard stories where Conan was a pirate.
Okay, okay. So, you said...
I wrote a sequel to Return of the Living Dead called Spawn of the Dead.
Really? I've never even heard of that.
Well, it never got made.
I never even heard it. There was...
Oh, man, on that film, everybody who could hold a pen or a pencil had a sequel written to Return of the Living Dead.
It's an amazing film. I mean, And of course, that film's been covered a lot. My question is, you said when I contacted you by email, you said that you sold your first script to Roger Corman and you're still friends with him.
Yes.
Oh, which sounds a little, well, people have heard tales, of course, but I mean, how well did it go? I mean, did you just present it to him or what happened? How did it happen?
Here's what happened is I was contacted by John Broderick.
Okay.
And... John asked me, I had a reputation as a guy who did presentation art for films. Back at that time period, you could, I did a lot of what's called presentation art, and that is a producer like Sandy Howard would come to me and say, okay, Bill, I've got 12 titles. Terror Train, teenage girls get terrorized on a train.
Okay.
And for each of those titles, I would do a fake one sheet, fake movie poster. And he would take the 12 titles and the 12 pieces of art to the Cannes Film Festival, and on the basis of that, no script, on the basis of the title and the art, he would get financing for 12 films.
This sounds like I remember being told that's what Hammer used to do back in the 60s.
Very common back then.
It
was amazing. And so I had a reputation for being very successful at doing the presentation art that would get the financing for your movie. So John Prodwick called me, and he asked me if I was familiar with gore. And I said, well, of course. And now I'm thinking G-O-R-E. He's thinking G-O-R, the John Norman novels.
Right, right, right. The series of increasingly sadomasochistic.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Sadomasochistic sword and sorcery.
Yeah.
And so, so it's sort of a mistaken thing. And so John arranged to have a meeting with me to talk about this project. And very quickly, he understood that I was thoroughly well-versed in the sword and sorcery genre of writing. And I was a big Robert E. Howard fan. And
right.
Stuff. And so he asked me if I would like to collaborate on the screenplay. And I said, sure, it sounded like a great opportunity. And then eventually, very quickly, it became not collaborate. It was just me doing all the writing and then John telling me what he needed rewritten.
Well, you mentioned last night that the finished film, the story in the finished film, is nowhere near close to what the script was. Is that true?
Not at all, yeah. So I'd never written a screenplay before. John expressed a huge passion for this film called Yojimbo, which I had never seen. Then I got a hold of a copy and watched it. And I'm like, oh, okay. So since I'd never written a screenplay, I didn't know how long they were. I didn't know a lot about structure and stuff.
I was about to say, even formatting.
So what I did is I made notes while I was watching Yojimbo, story notes, highlights, like that. And then I wrote a script based upon that, and then I went through and changed every single thing that was like Yojimbo, because I didn't want to plagiarize Yojimbo.
Okay.
But I had the right screenplay length now, and I had basically a decent structure, and so I wasn't in the dark anymore. It was like I found out, oh, okay, my screenplay turned out to be, I think it was 110, 120 pages, which is the standard screenplay length.
Right.
And I used that structure then to build my own story, and I wanted to do something really distinctive and really original. And there were some elements that really disturbed Broderick. For instance, there, one of the rulers of the little fiefdoms in that town had this pet creature. And I decided they had a sexual relationship.
Really?
And John, that just fried him. He was just like, he was so offended by that. I'm like, dude, it's like...
It's fantasy.
It's a fantasy, and we're not going to see him have sex. It's, you know...
It's just going to be implied.
It's just going to be implied that he loves and is so passionate about this creature, so that when something happens to it, he's devastated and at the same time furious. And it just gives deeper meaning and deeper passion and drama and contrast and everything else. And stuff.
Well, it ended up in the movie.
Well, the creature ended up in the movie, but there was no implications of a relationship other than it's a pet.
Well, that anger at its death is still there.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay.
But I wanted to come up with creatures that hadn't been seen in the film anymore. There was a giant worm, and there was the wasp woman with all the breasts.
Yeah.
And stuff. And so I think I did about 6 rewrites, and each one was like flaying my own skin off my flesh. It was just incredible. You know, because I would, with each rewrite, I think, I did it. Okay, now this is a beautiful screenplay. It's done. That's great.
Right.
And then John would go, now we need to change this. And I was like, oh, no. And I have to do a complete rewrite over and over and over again.
Were they arbitrary changes or changes?
No. It was a real learning experience for me.
Okay.
John had made several films. Did Big Bad Mama.
Yeah.
And he had a relationship. I don't know if he was still with Carol Lindley at that time or not, but he had a relationship with Carol Lindley. He was pretty entrenched in the film business.
Okay.
And he would do cool things, like he would take me to meet the guy who brought Godzilla to America and put Raymond Burr in it.
Turned it into
great old-time Hollywood producers and stuff. And that was fun. But we'd meet at Farmer's Market, which is a fairly famous hangout for screenwriters and producers and stuff.
Okay.
And just go over the script. And So I was learning how to write a screenplay. It's great.
Well, how long a process was this? How long did this take to run through all these different drafts?
Months. Months. And then his idea was to pitch it to Corman.
Okay.
And so he told me he had pitched it to Corman, but he didn't like Corman's reaction to it. Corman loved the screenplay. And then John said, but you know, Corman treated me like I was brand new to the film scene and stuff, and that really offended me, you know. And so,
all right.
And he said, okay, he said, so I'm gonna, you know, try to sell it somewhere else. I said, oh, fine. So, and I did a whole series of paintings of key scenes from the film to help support the pitch. So then we kind of drifted apart. I forgot about it, but I was doing posters for New World, for Roger. I did a poster Up from the Depths, Rock and Roll High School, Lady in Red.
Right.
And so I was keeping in touch with the art director that I was dealing with on the poster, and I'd call him from time to time and say, hey, you know, what's going on? He says, you know, we're doing this, doing that. I said, what films are in production right now? He says, oh, we got one here. It's King of Dark Planet being shot in Argentina. I go, King of Dark Planet? I wrote that.
Oh, so that's the original name of the story?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I said, have you got a copy of the script? He goes, yeah. I said, can you read me what the title page says? He goes, sure. It says, King of Dark Planet, original story and screenplay by John Broderick. I go, and? He goes, no, there's no and. I go, holy man. So next call was to my attorney.
yeah, I would say so.
And Roger's a really decent guy. As soon as Roger found out, he immediately cut me a check, taking the pay out of Broderick's paycheck.
Of course.
and then I get this call from Broderick from Argentina. Bill, what the hell are you doing? You just... It's my money. It's... I go, John... You took my name off the screenplay. How could you do that? Well, Bill, it's easier to sell a screenplay if there's only one name on it.
Since when? I mean, what the hell is
that? It's total bullshit.
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah, it's total bullshit. But as green as I was, I knew that was bullshit. You know, it's like, I'm not that stupid.
Yeah, how many movies have you seen? Take a look at the freaking credits.
Yeah, I mean,
oh,
really?
God, okay. All right.
So what happened was John got greenlit by Roger to make the film down in Argentina because Roger just shot a film there and said, we haven't turned down the sets yet, reuse the sets. And I think the budget was like $80,000.
Really?
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Oh, my
God. Unbelievably cheap.
Yeah. Okay.
John originally wanted his best friend, Gary Lockwood, to be in the lead. And I wanted David Carradine. I thought David would be perfect for it. Now, I was a fan of David Carradine's movie acting. I had never watched Kung Fu, ever.
Right.
And I didn't know that his name in Kung Fu was Kane, which was the same name.
Oh, this is just coincidence?
But different spelling is my son.
All right.
Yeah. So... Anyway, I was delighted that David got cast in the lead. I thought he'd be perfect. I thought he was a great actor.
Had you known him and met him? Had you known him before?
No, I'd never met him.
Okay.
I just admired his work and just really liked his films.
Cool. So, shot in Argentina. How long? Well, first of all, how did you get involved? I mean, how did you become a part of the production, not just the scriptwriters?
I was not a part of the production.
Oh, really?
I did not go down to Argentina. But John just brought my paintings down there and had them build sets of creatures based upon my paintings.
I was curious because your name does end
because
up
he didn't want me to know. He didn't want me to know he was making the film.
Really?
Because he had taken my name off of it.
Okay.
That's why.
Oh,
he was trying to do everything on the slide, get it finished, get it done, get it out before I found out about it.
But see, the reason I would have thought that... When were you doing the different drafts on the screenplay? What year was that? In other words, was that post Conan the Barbarian, or was it...
It was before Conan.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I always kind of figured that it was the looming success of that big budget production that pushed a lot of producers, big or small, to start making these types of films. But this one was in motion even before then. That's interesting. Okay. So
Sword and Sorcery was hot, not as a film genre. There was no sword and sorcery film genre back then, but as a book genre. It was cooking.
Oh, it was huge. The 70s saw all those reprints of the Robert E. Howard Conan stuff.
L. Sprite DeCamp, Wayne Carter, everybody's cranking out those books.
Okay. That makes sense, and that answers a question I've kind of had about that. So then
I saw the film right. at the World Theater in Hollywood, on Hollywood Boulevard, which is one of my favorite grindhouses. Three films, 99 cents. And ushers there had fully loaded shoulder pistols.
Really?
In their coats, yeah. I remember I was there on Halloween night, and they had three horror films, and I was with friends, and they showed two of the films, and then suddenly the lights went on, and Usher said, "We're going to go to the theater, we've got our company Halloween party." And I go, "Hey, I paid my 99 cents, I want to see that third film." And I'm getting angry about it, and my friend is grabbing my arm. He's Bill, cool it, just cool it. He goes, "Look." I look, and I see the gun. And I go, "Oh, you guys have your party.
Bye."
I don't want to get shot. But that place was so extraordinary. I remember I went to, that was where I first saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Perfect
really?
Place to see it.
I guess so.
The whole theater smelled like the inside of an old shoe. and I was sitting down, and I hear this commotion behind me. I go, "What the hell's going on?" And here come six guys in tuxedos with Zsa Zsa Gabor, and they sit down right behind me to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
You sat in a theater to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Zsa Zsa Gabor and her entourage.
Yeah, of six guys in tuxedos.
Holy crap.
It's like, man, only in Hollywood.
Okay.
It's just
okay.
Amazing. Okay. So anyway, so I go to see Kingdom of Dark Planet, which is no longer Kingdom of Dark Planet, it's War and the Sorcerers. And I talked to Roger. I said, "Roger, I don't mind you renaming my film, but War and the Sorcerers, there's no sorceress in the movie." And he said, "Bill, you have to understand, the object of the title of the film and the poster is to get asses into seats. Once we've got those asses in the seats, it doesn't matter if there's a sorceress in the film. But because there's a sorceress in the title, it means we can put a sexy girl on the poster." So,
true.
Okay, good lesson.
Yeah, good lesson, right?
Good lesson. Well, now, but then the film rolls, and I'm horrified because John had taken everything original in the screenplay and it reverted back, made it a total ripoff of Yojimbo.
Yeah.
And I think, oh my God, this is like plagiarizing Yojimbo, and it's got my name on it. And I was just horrified and embarrassed.
Well, what's funny is when I saw the film back in the VHS days when it came out, it's the first film that I had ever watched where a little ways into it, I realized, oh, this is a remake of Yojimbo and Fistful of Dollars.
Right.
Fistful of Dollars is a remake of Yojimbo. I was like, oh, that's interesting, setting it in a different time period, you know, put it in a fantasy setting or whatever. Yeah. And there are a lot of movies that do that, that have done that over the years. Some of them even going
back
to... So
did Yojimbo.
Correct, because it's Red Harvest by Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah.
And
that's why Kurosawa didn't sue Leone.
He couldn't. Because they know where the story came from, So it's absolutely fascinating that you started out, altered it, and then did he yank it back because he didn't have any...
He yanked it back because he loved Yojimbo. And he wanted to remake Yojimbo.
I just wondered if maybe it might have something to do with the changes that got made. Maybe he reverted to an earlier draft or an earlier idea and is just like, well, then I can... My stamp is more on it or something like that. But I guess there's no way to know. I mean, I guess it's just he wanted to remake Yojimbo. Really?
Remake Yojimbo, and John was not strong with dialogue, yet he rewrote most of my dialogue, which I had carefully crafted draft after draft after draft. And that was frustrating, too. It was like, oh, this is just like sort of on the nose, not very subtle dialogue.
So overall, what's your impression of the film? When was the last time you saw it?
Oh, it's been decades. But I shared a limo with David Carradine. We were both guests at Dragon Con.
Okay.
We shared a limo back to the airport. I said, "Okay, David, I wrote War and the Sorcerers. Tell me about your experience making that film. I was dying to hear tales and stuff." He said, "Well," he says, "got down to Argentina, and you know, and he was preparing for the role and everything and getting to know Broderick and all this stuff, and he saw Broderick very early give in on some production point. And David took John aside and said, John, we haven't even started shooting yet, and you have compromised. How many compromises are you going to make? Is this going to be your movie? He says, you're making compromises now. And Broderick woke up, and then he started to stand firm on his directorial decisions. And so okay, it was really good that David had that talk with him.
So, but I'm glad you got to compare notes with him, because I mean now that the chances of quizzing him on a film, you know, this small, I had no idea the budget was that small. Yeah. I mean, I knew it had been filmed in Argentina, and I'm sure it was for budgetary interest. But man, what a small budget. Yeah. In as you were writing the scripts, one of the standout things about it that I'm just curious about is, was there always supposed to be that much nudity involved? Or was that Corman going, okay, we need a lot of tits?
I just wrote the way I felt it, and it just happened to have nudity.
And believe me, I have nothing against the nudity in the film. Yeah. What's the actress?
Part of it was at a time when there's this brief period where you could do anything in films. It was that period of, you know, there was a book about that.
Easy Riders and Raging Bulls. Yeah.
Exactly. And so if you were young and you were a filmmaker, you just had total license to do whatever the hell you wanted for a very brief time in cinema history. And it was great. And so I didn't even think about restrictions or anything. I just wanted to tell a really compelling story that was really visually colorful.
Well,
so I had painted her with the breasts exposed and everything.
Oh, really? Okay. I don't know that I've ever seen more than just like the poster art for the thing. So I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't do the poster.
Yeah,
which is odd.
That is odd. That's even odder now that I think about it.
Especially since I was doing posters for Roger at the time.
Yeah. Now, to segue, during that period of time, you were working, doing storyboards, production art, different things on a lot of De Laurentiis' fantasy films of the time.
That came, the first De Laurentiis film I did was Conan the Barbarian. I started that in 1979.
Okay. Well, I didn't know the production started that early, but yeah. I guess it makes sense. The film came out in 81. Okay.
Yeah.
And you kind of went from there to working on, you also did Conan the Destroyer and
Red Sonja. The first film I did after Conan the Barbarian was First Blood.
Oh, no, what did you do on First Blood?
I storyboarded all the action sequences.
Okay. You worked with Ted Kotcheff, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Andy Laszlo, great DP. I learned a lot from Andy. He would take me aside and show me stuff through the lenses and everything and show me what he's planning to do, how he's planning to move the camera. It was a real education. And then and it was interesting because Kotcheff, he did not bring me on as the storyboard artist. It was Buzz Feitschens, the same line producer as Conan.
All right.
And Buzz brought me on. Buzz is a smart guy. What he does is, so that everybody's on the same page, he will Xerox the storyboards and put them on the backs of the call sheets. So everybody knows visually, this is what we're doing today. This is how it's going to look. This is how it's going to. So it saves so much time. Now, Kotcheff was resistant to me at first because he felt that there's a possibility of me encroaching upon his turf. Because storyboards is like directing on paper.
Right.
But I immediately sensed that and put him at ease. I said, Ted, I'm here for you. You want to change anything, it's just lines on paper. It's out. Anything you want, you put it in. And this way we can save a lot of time, a lot of dough, because we can tell the story visually on paper first, just the way you want to tell it. And, you know, you are totally in control. This is not my movie, this is your movie. And once he realized that, he really got enthusiastic and into storyboarding. And why don't we try this? Let's try this. Let's see if this works. Oh, that's not working. What if we add this here? And so he became a total convert.
Well, that's interesting because at that point he'd been making movies. He'd been directing for well over a decade.
Yeah.
I mean, Wake in Fright in 71 with Donald Pleasance down in Australia.
He did North Dallas 40.
Yeah, he did North Dallas 40, which is a great movie.
I love I'm not even a football fan, but that film is killer.
That movie is, it's, it, it, that's one I caught on the early HBO in the 80s, and it's just one, you know, early 80s, and it's just, it's, what a wake-up call. If you are a football fan, what a wake-up call to go, wow, this is what,
right, fellas, what it's like.
This is so harsh. There's some of what these people are going through. Yeah. It's a really good film.
Great Nick Nolte performance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. The, we were talking earlier about the Red Sonja stuff. One of my favorite bad movies of all time. I absolutely love it, and I really shouldn't. But I will defend the score to my grave. I just I love that Morricone score. I think it's phenomenal.
The Basil Polidori score for Conan.
Oh,
that
amazing.
Has been used as a temp track and for trailers for so many movies. It's unbelievable.
It's great music. It is so powering. It's almost overpowering. It's just so thunderous and fits so well to everything that comes to it.
Yeah. But, originally, John wanted, I think it was Carmina Burana, and then that got used by Borman in Excalibur.
Okay.
And so we can't use that.
What did you do on Red Sonja?
Red Sonja creature designs.
Oh, okay. The kind of armored underwater thing.
Yep.
Who built that sucker?
Don't know. That was a kind of a quick in and out. They hired me for a few weeks to design the creatures, and then I was off my next film.
Did you do any of the design of any of the sets, or were those already in place?
Yeah, no sets.
Okay.
I did a whole series of films for Dino. But Conan the Barbarian was... I had done films before that. My first film was... I can't remember. It was either Buck Rogers or the Firesign Theater's Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Well, that's right. I just realized that you did some work on the pilot movie, or it was that...
Buck Rogers was originally not going to be a TV series. It was going to be 3 2-hour films.
Really?
Mostly meant for the European market. And then... as it was progressing, they thought, oh, this will make a cool TV show, and they turned it into a TV show.
Okay, what were you working on with it?
With that, I was designing spaceships, costumes, weapons, insignias, just anything I wanted to design, they gave me free rein.
Really?
It was pretty amazing.
How'd you get involved in Pan's Labyrinth, by the way?
Pan's Labyrinth, I've got a lot of mutual friends with Guillermo del Toro, and they... Like I was saying about David Lynch, they kept saying, you and Guillermo are going to really hit it off, man. You guys have so much in common.
I would imagine.
And in that case, we really did.
Yeah.
We really did. But we just kept missing each other. Ships in the Night, just kept missing each other. Finally, my friend Frank Darabont, he throws a dinner every Comic-Con one night at the best restaurant in San Diego, and invites all his artist friends there, and occasionally directors as well, Cronenberg and different people. And he invited Guillermo. And so that's where I met Guillermo, was at that dinner. And Guillermo said, you know, I want to come by, I want to see your work.
Right.
And I have a little project I'm thinking about. Anyways, I'm fine. So he came by the next morning, he bought 2 pieces of work of mine. One of which was... the pinup I did for Hellboy, called Hellboy at the Mountains of Madness. With a Lovecraftian theme and all that stuff. And little did I know that At the Mountains of Madness is the film that he wants to make the most, which is one of the films I want to make the most. Especially having lived in Antarctica, I can bring a lot of the reality of what it's like to be down there to the design. So he asked me if I would mind delivering the pictures to him at his home. I said, sure, that'd be great. So I drove out to his home, gave him the pictures, and he says, the reason I have you here is I want to propose a project I would like you to work on. It's called Pan's Labyrinth, and I want you to design the creatures for the film. And he said... it's a low-budget film. I know what your rate is. I can only afford you for, I think it was either a week or 2 weeks. I couldn't remember. I think it was just 1 week. And I said, you know, fine. And then suddenly the phone rang. He answered the phone, and I hear on his end, oh, thank you very much. But no, I will have to pass. I need to make my little Spanish film now. Hangs up. I don't know what was all that about. It was Warner Brothers. They just offered me Harry Potter. And I said, my esteem for him just shot right up. Wow. He blew off Harry Potter to do his little Spanish film.
Hey. Wow.
This guy's got integrity.
How you doing? Good.
And he also talked to me about his hiring philosophy.
Oh, nice.
He says, you know, in this business, there's a catch-22. A lot of really great young designers would like to break into the business, but the first question they get asked is, what films have you done? If none, you don't get the chance to get in.
Yeah.
So he says, what I do is if I see someone who's promising, I would give them one day's work on one of my films. Now they have a film credit. Now that is their entry into the film business.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I met him several years ago, well, back when he was premiering Mimic, down at Dragon Con in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And couldn't be a nicer guy. When you said people were telling you that you had a lot in common with him, having met and talked with him and bought comic books with him, trust me, I know you've got a lot in common with Guillermo del Toro. Just a nice guy. Yeah. Can talk on a zillion subjects.
Yeah.
Just amazingly nice guy. But
Then he talked to me about At the Mountains of Madness. He says, here's my dream build. I want the film to be designed by you, Mike Mignola, and Wayne Barlow. He says, Mike Mignola and Wayne Barlow hate each other's guts. It will be incredible to put them in a room together.
Are you kidding me? Oh, shit. No, they hate each other. What the hell? Oh, my God. Okay, well, hey. Well, I mean, he was going through all this hell trying to get At the Mountains of Madness lined up for...
Yeah. We were about to do it, and then Pacific Rim came up, and he had to do that.
Both of them moving along, and that's just the one that came up first.
I think it was pressure from the studio or something. I don't know what it was, but
the rumors were him staunchly defending an R rating for it, and them worried about the budget
Mountains
for Mountains. Yeah,
yeah.
So I mean, so has there been any pre-production work done for it at this point? Is it any?
I think there has been, but I haven't seen any of it.
Keep hoping that he'll be able to get back to that one.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Years ago, one of the things he was talking about back when I met him, you know, late 90s, he was talking about this project. It's this bizarre Western as well. Yes, bizarre fantasy Western. I mean, I'm sure he still has this idea lurking there in the back of his head because the Mounds of Madness thing he talked about as well.
Yeah.
We get to sit down and talk with him and Planet Hollywood, and then, like I say, we ended up shopping for comic books with him the next day. And he was describing certain things about it. But it's like a gothic Western. Was how he says, that's my pitch. That would be the way. That'd be the first thing I would say to our producers. It's a gothic Western, and then I'd see how they reacted to that, and then go into details.
Yeah.
And I hope that's a project that I. Every time I see him having to waste time and something not come to fruition, like Mountains of Madness, or when he spent all that time on The Hobbit before he had to bail out because it was just delay, I'm like, yeah, but I want to see that thing. I want to see the gothic Western, man. What'd you do on The Mist? Was it posters?
I did creature designs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I did it for free just as a favor to Frank. And then I did my first batch of creature designs, and then I got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And I just sort of bailed. But it all worked out. I opted for a prostatectomy, and everything's fine now. I'm back to running 3 miles of hills every other day. And it's cool.
Thank God. This is kind of one of those kind of geeky interview questions that I try to stay away from because things are much better organically. But I look at those fantasy films you were involved with in the 80s, and I have a weakness for those things. Good, bad, or who the hell cares? There's something about them. And I think you pinpointed something. Those films came at the tail end of that period that was the 70s. It's the tail end of that. Anything goes. The studios, I mean, the doors are thrown open, both with the rating system, you know, with the Hays Code being finally completely tossed out, and we now have a rating system, and we can do whatever the hell we want.
And you can make X-rated films. Midnight Cowboy.
One of the greatest. Yeah, exactly. Just an astonishing movie. And
that was coming to a close by the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. By the time Top Gun rolls around and things like that, the idea of the blockbuster that had started with like Jaws and Star Wars has fully taken hold, and it's either, you know, it's either going to be big or it's going to be something I'm not going to bother with for a lot of people working in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But those movies, those fantasy movies, they were modestly budgeted for the most part. I mean, Conan had a big budget.
Yeah.
But nothing else really did.
Had a big budget, but they cut a lot of stuff.
Did they?
They cut the entire city of Shadazar, and I had done, Cobb and I had done loads of designs on that.
Ron Cobb, you?
Yeah, and I remember when Ron was called out of the room, basically they were telling him, we're cutting Shadazar and all this stuff, and he was doing this huge argument on behalf of keeping it in the movie.
Right.
And I was on the other side of the door. My head was red, steam's coming to my ears. I was so furious at these people for not understanding.
This was early in the process or during production?
This was while we were in Zagreb.
Okay.
Yeah, this is pre-production in Zagreb.
Good Lord.
It was a good thing I wasn't in that room. I mean, oh, I got to tell you one story.
What?
So I get... So I'm suing Dale Laurentiis because they stole my artwork, and then suddenly, mysteriously, a big batch of the artwork shows up at my doorstep, and the next day I get the call to work on Conan the Destroyer.
Okay, so this is
Gee, what timing?
So something we want this lawsuit to go away.
They send me the script to Conan the Destroyer, and it's horrible. It's the worst piece of shit I ever read.
It's a terrible script,
and I love Robert E. Howard, and so. I mean, this is completely naive. I rewrote the entire screenplay and then printed it up and went to the first production meeting. And I walked in, and it's Richard Fleischer and Raffaella De Laurentiis and other people involved. And I said, oh, ooh, what's that smell? Oh, something really stinks. Oh, it's this screenplay. And I took the Conan the Destroyer screenplay and threw it across the room. And then I started handing out my screenplay to everybody at the room.
And how did that go over?
Well, no one said anything. We proceeded to talk about pre-production for Conan the Destroyer and stuff. But I found out after I left, Fleischer just exploded. Who in the fuck was that asshole? And it was Raffaella De Laurentiis who smoothed everything over. She said, oh, that's a beer. He's very passionate about a Conan, and he just wants to make a great movie. It's okay. It'll be fine.
So was that your only time in the room with Richard Fleischer?
No. I saw Richard throughout the production.
Oh, okay.
And you know, she did a good job of smoothing it over. And
in fact,
there was one great time. They gave me a lot of free rein in that film, and I noticed in the script, it said something like, you know, Conan and his band of adventurers cross the desert. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if they were in the distance and so almost silhouette crossing the desert? In the deep foreground, there's this rotting carcass of a mammoth to let you know you're in the Hyborian Age. This is not like any other world you've seen.
Yeah.
And so I did a painting of that. And Fleischer came into the art department. He looked at that, and his eyes popped wide open. He ran out. And he pulled Jack Cardiff, the great cinematographer
who I
deeply respect.
And how can you not look at his list of credits
for God's sake?
His work is amazing.
Ugh. So Cardiff looked at it, turned to me, said, "I'm going to make it look exactly like that." And I was like, "Ooh!"
What was Jack Cardiff like? Oh my God!
The sweetest guy, such a gentleman, and just a total artist, and incredible. They rebuilt that whole mammoth thing, sculpted it and everything, and then they took it out of the desert, and I had vultures in my picture picking at the carcass and stuff, and so they got, you know, like a dozen vultures, and they clipped their wings so they couldn't fly, and then arranged them all over the carcass, and then stood back to get the shot, and not realizing that in addition to good flyers, vultures are really good runners. The vultures jumped off and took off across the Sonora Desert. So for the next 2 hours, crew was chasing vultures all over the desert trying to get these damn birds back. And they finally got them back, and then they, with leather straps, they lashed them to the carcass and then got the shot.
All right. That's, that's... Now all I can do is picture that. That's horrible. The reason I ask about Fleischer is, I mean, you look at the end of his career where he made Conan the Destroyer and... Amityville 3D, and then you're like, this is the guy who made Narrow Margin, one of the greatest film noir ever.
This is the best movie.
It's an amazing film. And he made, this is the guy who made 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea for Disney.
Yeah.
It's like, how the hell did he end up doing
Boston Strangler.
Boston Strangler, yeah.
Vikings.
I love the Vikings, but I know you don't.
I don't. We had, when I was working on Conan, we were working out of the, at first we were working out of the A-Team offices in Spielberg, but then we moved to Dino De Laurentiis' offices in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And every Friday night, there was a screening room at Dino's place. Every Friday night, we'd have a screening. It was usually John's films.
Okay.
So we could be educated as to John's visual sense and style and everything. But also, we would pull films that we thought were appropriate for inspiring us on our Conan work. And one of them was John wanted to arrange for a screening of The Vikings. And we were all really excited until we saw the film. And boy, for none of us, it did not hold up at all.
Really? I love it. It's a big cartoon. That's what I like
recently?
About it. Yeah, well, yeah. I haven't watched it about 3 years, but there was a period of time I watched it like at least once a year.
Yeah, it is like a cartoon.
That's what it is, yeah. But it also has some things that you don't expect out of a film that you would think of as mainly as a cartoon. I love the line from Kirk Douglas when he enters this Christian church, and the priest is praying and crossing himself, and Kirk's whole reaction to it is, take your God elsewhere, old man, or something. Take your God elsewhere, holy man. This total dismissal of his religion because he doesn't care. And it's just little things like that. There's a lot of little things like that in it that are just like, well, it's just a big action cartoon with a kind of a crazy amount of events happening. But
loved it as a kid.
Yeah.
When it first came out.
That's when I think it may be one of those movies that you have to see it as a kid to really love it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can maintain that feeling as you get older. But if you don't see it for years and years and years, you come to it and all you have are those memories, I can understand your reaction. Yeah. So what are you working on lately?
Well, by the time we made Conan the Destroyer, to me, I was offended by his filmmaking. It seemed like he was not. He had no passion for any of the film projects he was doing. It was like sausage. Really? He was making one right after another.
Oh,
he
didn't give a shit. Well, that explains the end of his career then. That's sad. Yeah. I understand. Well,
I mean, that may not be true, but that's just the vibe that I got. That he didn't care about Conan. There's another film to make, and then I'm off the next one, make that one, off the next one, make that one.
And it shows in Conan the Destroyer. It really, I mean, there's a lackluster nature to the proceedings. Occasionally, it pops to life.
But. Well, especially after working on Conan the Barbarian, where Milius was so passionate about the project.
Yeah.
I mean, as he would finish, he'd finish a couple pages, and the first thing he'd do is he'd run into the art department and have us read them, get our reaction and response. He wanted to know, you know. Is this okay? Do you love it? You know, it was great.
Well, what do you feel? I asked you about, you know, what do you feel about Warrior and the Sorcerers, which is what started us down this path. But what are you looking back? What do you think of Conan the Barbarian?
That film is really interesting to me because the first time I saw it, it was the first time I'd seen my work in a major motion picture, and my first reaction was, wait a minute, you're going too fast. I spent months on that set, and it's on screen for 5 seconds. Oh, my God. Hey, slow it down. Linger a little bit, would you? You know? So there was that. And then the second time, I thought, I need to see this with a real audience.
Yeah,
so
see how they react.
I went to the World Theater. Three films, 99 cents. Uh-huh. Conan was playing.
A grindhouse to see Conan.
Grindhouse.
Okay.
And it was a highly enjoyable experience. There were a couple of black dudes sitting in front of me, and one of them was doing a running commentary throughout the film.
Oh, really?
What was going on the screen.
Oh, God.
And the other guy would go, mm-hmm.
Just agree with it.
Mm-hmm. And at the point, well, I love it, at the point where Thulsa Doom cuts off Conan Mom's head, suddenly the one guy goes, oh, my God, he took a head. He took a head. Hit that dude so bad, he took a head. Mm-hmm. He took a head. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is great. This is so cool.
Oh, man. Talk about a unique experience.
So then the third time I saw it was on cable.
Okay, yeah.
And I watched it, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the worst piece of shit I've really? Ever seen. I was just like, oh, the acting is so bad, and the lighting, and the way it's shot. Oh, that's, God.
You didn't even like the lighting?
Oh, man. There,
cinematography, I love in that film. It's,
there were scenes where either Ron or I would carefully design and color coordinate everything in the set, and the DP would come in and throw a big red light on everything.
It's like, really?
Well, fuck, you just destroyed weeks of work with that stupid fucking red light.
Shit.
You know? It's like, ugh. But then when I was making Conan the Destroyer down in Mexico City, they announced that they were going to have a screening of the first Conan film.
Okay.
And so John Bloomfield, the costume designer, and I worked on both films. John Bloomfield, like, well, we should go see it. Yeah, it's a piece of shit, but
what the hell?
Right. What the hell? Let's go see it. And watched the film. Lights went on. I looked at John. John looked at me. Tears were streaming down our eyes, and we both looked at each other. It's a fucking classic.
You 180 that harsh?
Yeah.
I mean that quickly on
yeah.
thing? Really?
Yeah.
What? Is it just that? Well, your negative reaction was watching it on television. I mean, is it just seeing it on the big screen? Is it being overwhelmed by it?
Seeing it on the big screen has such a dramatic effect on you as a viewer. I mean, watching any film on a TV, especially back then, there were not big screen TVs.
Yeah.
Anymore. It just diminishes the experience so much that what are you left with? You're left with really looking at the performances of the actors.
Right.
And Arnold's not an actor. Jerry Lopez, by no means an actor.
Yeah.
They even had to dub his, you know, all his dialogue.
Right, right.
And for some reason on television, all the weaknesses of the film just stood out in high relief. Whereas in a theater experience, for one, you're watching with a whole lot of people.
Right,
that affects your experience. And on a big screen, you can see details that you can't see on television.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the joys of the Blu-ray and giant screen TV age is you can get back to some of that without having to be in a theater. So.
Yeah. And I love that script. I think it is one of the most romantic things that Milius has ever written. That when
he's not exactly known for romanticism.
He's not known for romanticism, but when I was reading the pages, it's like, oh my God, when Valeria dies, she says, let me breathe my last breath into your mouth.
Yeah.
It's like, cool.
And it works. She's not a particularly great actress either.
But she's wonderful.
But she works in that film.
Yeah, she does.
Really does. I was just curious. We'd never talked about Conan the Barbarian.
Now I love the film.
Well, I do too. Well, you're aware that there's a slightly longer version of it that came out on DVD a few years back.
Yeah.
And the big controversy is that's not the version they put on Blu-ray, which pissed everybody off. Because it's like it's just a few minutes, but it's really nice because it lengthens a few spots that kind of make the film feel better.
Yeah.
It gives it a little bit more, I wouldn't say breadth, but maybe a little more depth, maybe.
Yeah. There was a sort of stupid, destructive thing that went on during the editing of that film that Dino was insisting on a certain length, as he did with Doom.
Really?
And Milius, in his defiance of Dino, said, oh, you want me to cut it that short? I'm going to cut it shorter. You know,
really?
And they were trying to outdo each other with how short can we make this movie.
You butcher a film that way.
Yeah. It's counterproductive. It's not what does the film need. It became these two egos clashing. And, oh, you think you can cut it? I can cut it. Oh, you think you can cut it? I can cut it even shorter than that. And not good. Not good for the movie.
Well, I won't take up any more of your time. I know you need to get to your table, or at least.
I got to check out, too.
Oh, yeah, you got to check out. Well, I'm sure you've already. Oh, God, I have to as well. Crap. Well, thank you, Mr. Sound.
Oh, you're welcome.
And,
it's a pleasure.
This is a joy. I'm just glad we were able to do this. Thanks again, man.
Cool. Awesome.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
So there we have a conversation with William Stout. As I say, it started off talking about the warrior and the sorceress, but we did kind of range all over a bunch of different topics. Once again, apologize for the sound quality. It was as good as I could get it at the time. Next year, Mr. Stout has agreed to do this again, and next year, you know what? We won't do it in a hallway where people are walking by. It'll sound better. And you know what? I really want to get his thoughts on Dune, because he worked for a long time on Dune, David Lynch's film Dune. And man, I'm utterly fascinated by that film, as I know a lot of other people are. And I can't wait to, hear the stories he's got about that film. I've heard a few of them already, and man, they're impressive. But hope you enjoyed this conversation with William Stout. Take my advice. Check out his work. I'll provide a link to his website in the show notes. So please check out the show notes. I'll check out the link to his site. You can see the long, long, long list of credits, films that he's worked on, and things that he's done. See a good bit of his artwork. I'm a particular fan of his poster artwork, of course, being a poster artwork lunatic. And I think you will find many things there to enjoy. Remember, you can contact me. We have an email address here, thebloodypit@gmail.com. Write, let us know what you think. This podcast is incredibly erratic. You never know when one is going to come out or what the subject matter may be. But in the near future, there will be an episode focusing one way or another on the Beastmaster. And also one soon featuring a conversation between me and my podcasting partner over on the NashiCast, focusing on his fascination with Godzilla. He won't tell me exactly what we're going to focus on specifically, but that's coming up. So once again, thanks to you for listening. A big thank you to William Stout for being willing to go on record and talk about some of this stuff. So tune in again the next time I get another show finished and edited and uploaded, and we'll talk to you then. Until then, this is Rod Barnett for The Bloody Pit saying thank you and come again. Get far.
Oh.